American Cassette Ministries welcomes you to another hour of delightful learning with noted author, lecturer, and physician, Dr. Agatha Thrash. Her topic is Simple Home Remedies.
I'd like to talk with you this morning about several different items. The first thing that I want to talk with you about is that of hypertension. We have two places in our written material where you can get information on hypertension. One is our Health Emphasis Seminar syllabus. This is a little $1 syllabus. It has a lot of compact information in it dealing with everything from depression and memory problems and sleep and constipation, gas, circadian rhythms, hypertension, cancer risks, coronary risks, arthritis, how to treat a cold, and a lot of other things. It's packed full of very, very good information. You will see that it isn't so artistically designed as our other books are, but I like it because it has a lot of information in it and people can get a lot of material for their money. And if you would like that, I would like to suggest, it's not that it's not at all artistic, it's just that it's not quite the printing quality that our other material is. And I'd like to suggest that you, if you want to send a little gift to somebody as a birthday gift or something of that nature, that you consider something like that that will be helpful to people, help mothers know how to treat colds in their children and the like, and that can be very helpful. We also have another place where we have hypertension treated in greater detail, and that's in More Natural Remedies. So if anyone is interested in a longer treatise and more information, they could get that in More Natural Remedies. Now, I'd like to tell you a bit about how we treat hypertension. First thing is that of exercise. Get plenty of exercise every day. That means 7 days a week. And the quantity of exercise is what you can do in the length of time that you have to spend in it. Now set aside no less than 20 minutes in a day and fill that 20 minutes with your exercise. Now some people will be able to cover a little more than a mile in 20 minutes. Another person will hardly be able to stroll a block and back in 20 minutes. But whatever you can do, take that exercise that you can take and do it daily. Do it out of doors. We mentioned yesterday about the beneficial effects of the negative ions. Now, if a person simply runs in place for 6 minutes, that will reduce the blood pressure. Most people can easily run 6 minutes in place. Use a soft surface such as a bath mat or some kind of exercising mat and do your running in place on that, or do it outside on a grassed area. That can be a very nice way to bring your blood pressure down very quickly. Also, hot baths will bring your blood pressure down, and the reason for that is that it warms up the extremities, brings the blood from the interior of the body, takes it out to the extremities, and that is invariably capable of bringing your blood pressure down. So if you want to have a good remedy that will bring an acutely elevated blood pressure down, that's your remedy. Don't step into a very hot bath, because as you very well know, if you step into a hot bath, it makes your hair stand on end and goosebumps come up. That means that smooth muscle is contracting all over the body, and since blood vessels have smooth muscles in them, they contract and that sends your blood pressure up. So get into a nicely warm bath and slowly elevate the temperature so that it comes up higher. But don't forget that a hot bath will invariably bring the blood pressure down. Stay in it from 5 to 35 or 55 minutes, whatever you can easily tolerate, and that will be a nice treatment. Now, you will recognize the rationale of wearing warm clothing. If you have high blood pressure, don't allow your extremities to get chilled. That means making certain that the skin all over the body is the same temperature that the skin of the forehead is. These things are important to you. And having a tranquil mind is also very important. That means eliminating stress. Exercise neutralizes stress, and that's such an important remedy. I'd like for you to say that with me. Exercise neutralizes stress. Everybody together. Exercise neutralizes stress. Now, if you want a tranquilizer, that's what it is. If somebody offers you a tranquilizer over the backyard fence, you say, come, let's take a walk. That's the kind of tranquilizer I can heartily recommend. It is the only true tranquilizer. Take that. Our Heavenly Father has given us a large variety of things out in nature that we can look at, from sand and rocks and trees. How many different species of animals did Dr. Callahan say yesterday we have out in nature? Was some enormous number, like 600,000 different species. There is no dearth of materials there. Clouds and leaves and plants and flowers. It is all there to attract the mind and to make certain that you have something to listen to or look at or experience apart from those things that may trouble you. So get out in nature and learn what our Heavenly Father has placed there for us. Now the next thing, and the most important thing, is diet. If you're not planning to do this, then go to the doctor and get your drugs. But a word about the drugs. 1982, the American College of Cardiologists met, I believe it was in Chicago, in February. At that meeting, a most astounding article was presented. Some cardiologists had taken 30,000 patients, and for 11 years, they had followed them. They had divided them into two groups, those who took medication and those who did not. They found 65% more deaths in those who took the medication than in those who did not take the medication. Well, of course, that was very startling. Doctors were trying to help their patients live longer, and here, their very best attempts were resulting in a 65% greater mortality rate. The president of the American College of Cardiology stood up before the American College and said, this flies in the face of everything that we have ever taught concerning the treatment of hypertension. And it deserves much more study. Well, in the succeeding 3 years, we have had at least four major reports showing the same thing. And yet, doctors are still treating hypertension with medications. But as long as we have such a strong cartel in the drug company, we can expect that drugs will continue to be used and they will represent what we consider to be the main line of treatment for disease. But I hope that you will take a bit more responsibility for your health and take the more safe and cheaper and better way to treat your bodies. Now, so far as diet is concerned, here is what you do. Number one, it's a non-stimulatory diet. That means no spices, no coffee, no fermented foods, those things that stimulate the metabolic systems. And we've gone over a number of those. Fruits, vegetables, and whole grains represent the great bulk of one's diet. Anything else that is taken, regardless of what it is, should be taken sparingly. Item number two has to do with the concentrated foods. That would be primarily fats, but also such things as nuts, all animal products, seeds, wheat germ, food yeast, anything that is a concentrated food. Personally, I believe that also includes vitamins and minerals and the like, although on occasion a person who is deficient in something can have an elevation of the blood pressure because of a deficiency of a nutrient, which then allows an imbalance and the person develops a hypertension because of that. Question is, would I consider a nut a concentrated food? Yes, it is concentrated, but we may use some nuts. But you should not use more than 1/6 to 1/10 of any dish as nuts. Immediately you can recognize that granola recipes are often rich and unhelpful dishes. Many casseroles are rich and unhelpful dishes. Some breads are rich and unhelpful for that same reason. Do not enrich the foods with rich and unwholesome foods with a large quantity of them. Nuts may be properly used. You may use some with every meal, fruit meals or vegetable meals, although generally fruit meals and vegetable meals should be served separately. Some seeds can be properly taken. Sesame seed, pumpkin seed are high in zinc and are good for men. Calcium can be found in large quantities in sesame seed. There are some seeds that are toxic, such as poppy seeds, and we should, if we use them at all, they should be in a light sprinkle just occasionally once a year as a small decoration. I'd like to tell you a story about a man who came to us with hypertension just to illustrate the routine that we expect a hypertensive patient will have. We expect that when they come to us, they will go away without hypertension. It's just one up and one down almost in the treatment of hypertension. If people follow what we say, we expect that they will not be unsuccessful in treating hypertension. This man was at least 100 pounds overweight. He was a retired Army sergeant. He came to me when he got in my office. I said, when I found out he was a retired Army sergeant, I said, "Mr. Gilbert, why are you coming to see me when you could get your medical care free out at Martin Army Hospital?" He said, "Well, my wife heard that you folks were doing something with hypertension here, and very frankly, I'm just here to appease her. I didn't want to come a step." So I said, "Well, what has your wife heard?" He said, "Well, she has heard that you're treating high blood pressure with nutrition and exercise and things like that, and that you have had success in areas where drugs have not been successful. And since I am taking 3 medications for my heart and a number of other medications, and my blood pressure continues to soar," he felt that maybe he should do what his wife said. So there he was, head down, lumbered into my office, and clumsily fell into the chair. He looked as if he were dying. That's what he told me. He said, "I am dying." He said, "I want to tell you at the beginning that I will not go to the hospital because I know I'm dying. I don't mind dying, but as long as I live, I must continue in what I am doing. So I'm not going to stop and go to the hospital. So don't even suggest that." So I was stymied again. So in the course of talking with him, I began to recognize that his wife was the key to his success. So I started writing out a list of things for him to take home to his wife. And I gave the list of pretty much the things that I had just mentioned to you, including a no-salt diet. Now, the person who is hypertensive must use no salt. It's absolutely zero. The person who is hypertensive should use no fat. That's zero. Now, that just means free salt and free fats, except where dairy products are concerned. Dairy products must be eliminated totally because they're high in salt and high in fat. Mammary glands are very close to sweat glands. Sweat glands put out a lot of sodium in their secretion, and mammary glands put out a lot of sodium in their secretion. So you cannot take any kind of reasonable serving of dairy products and be on a low-salt diet. You're just kidding yourself if you think that you can, and you will eventually end up with medication. So just go ahead at the outset and abolish all dairy products. Fats would be margarine, mayonnaise, fried foods, cooking fats. Now, the way to keep your salt content down below 1,000 milligrams per day is the guidelines that we have been given by Dr. Lewis Dahl. Number one is use no salted food. That's no salt added at the factory, at the stove, or at the table. Number two is eliminate dairy products. Number three, use no prepared foods. That would be things like canned foods and some frozen foods, any kind of prepared meats. You cannot use anything of that nature. It's best to go to the market and get all of your things from the produce market rather than from canned and frozen things unless they specifically say no salt added. Then the fourth thing is never even consider approaching a vending machine. Nothing comes from one that you can take if you have hypertension. with those four guidelines, you should be able to keep your sodium intake below 1,000 milligrams, your salt intake below 1,000 milligrams a day. So I wrote that out for Mr. Gilbert's wife, and he took that home to his wife, and I didn't know whether I would ever see him again because I was afraid that his wife could not be successful in helping him if she had not been successful in helping him not to gain 100 pounds overweight. But with and another thing, I told him that I would not consider taking his case, as complicated as it was and as near death as he was. By the way, his blood pressure was 220 over 120. And at that point, I was a little jolted, so I said, I really feel that the only counsel that I can give you that is safe is for you to go into the hospital. That's when he told me, reiterated that he would not go. I told him that I would not undertake his case unless he would have a daily blood pressure check at one of our facilities around the city, at our one of our two health food stores, or at our Better Living Center. So he promised that he would come daily. The very next day, his blood pressure was down about 10 points on both the systolic and the diastolic. I was quite gratified. The next day, it was down some more, and when I saw him a week later, his blood pressure was 180 over 105. So I said, well, Mr. Gilbert, I think we might be able to handle your case all right as an outpatient. Tell me what happened this past week. He said, within 20 minutes of my getting home last week, my wife had me in a hot bath. And this whole week, she has been following your counsel to the letter. The first 3 days, I fasted with nothing but apples. He said, after that, apples have been found by Dr. Levine to have a factor in them that brings the blood pressure down. So they're very good for people to take. An apple a day is very good for those who have high blood pressure. And to make a very long and packed full of human interest story short, today, Mr. Gilbert's blood pressure is 107 to 112 over 72 to 78, right where it has been for the last 4 years. Now, we expect this kind of story routinely with high blood pressure. We just never fail with them. I say never fail. We do have some people who either fail to comply or we have to work at it a little while. One man came with a high blood pressure. We worked with him very diligently. And every day his blood pressure was still up. One day my husband was listening to the medical reports at our medical conference, and this was after he had been with us about 10 days. His blood pressure was still up. My husband was puzzling over the case. He heard the physician assistant present the case, and he was sort of droning on, saying, well, he's enjoying his diet, he's taking his walks good, he's getting his saline nasal baths for his allergies. And my husband said, saline nasal baths. That's where his problem lies, maybe. Let's do without the saline nasal baths and let's see what happens. They cut out the saline nasal baths, and the very next day his blood pressure was down to normal. Sometimes you cannot immediately tell exactly what is happening with a patient, but I believe that simple means will bring the blood pressure down in all primary essential hypertension cases. Now, in secondary hypertension, such as from severe kidney disease or cancers of the urinary tract, we may not be able to bring the blood pressure down with these methods. The most important discovery that has been made in medical science that supports the simple remedies for disease, I believe, has been the discovery of endorphins and enkephalins. These were discovered in Sweden about 9 years ago, and at that time their significance was not fully appreciated. But in these past 9 years, there have been discovered at least 9 systems internally for the control of disease. This is a control center for anemia, a control center for pain, one for gastrointestinal problems, another one for appetite. One has been discovered for nausea. One has been discovered for sexuality. There are 9 that are definitely known and 5 others that are suspected of being known. And what happens is that a certain stimulus is received from the body's signals into the brain. The brain produces endorphins, which is a brain hormone and also a neurotransmitter, which transmits the electrical impulse from one nerve cell to another, then the this substance switches on our internal mechanism for the healing of disease, and the body heals itself. Now, let's go back to the beginning. What was the initial stimulus? It was your symptom, whatever that was. If it were pain, the pain was received in the brain. In response to the signal, the symptom, the brain turned on the endorphins, made some, made whatever quantity was needed. If you have a little pain, a little endorphin was produced. If you have a lot of pain, a lot is produced. Then the body opens up the floodgates, whatever degree it needs to make it so that you can stop having the unpleasant symptom. Or it heals that basic disease that causes the unpleasant symptom. At any rate, the body itself has healed itself. The period of time that the endorphin works is rather short. For this reason, a dose of morphine that is 5 milligrams works for the same period of time that one that is 45 milligrams works. You would expect that 45 milligrams would have a much longer time span because of the half-life of morphine. But it does not work that way. Morphine has a certain period of time in which it works. That's because morphine makes a signal to the brain. Within 10 minutes after you're taking the shot of morphine, the body knows that it has been hit by something biochemical. The brain understands that, turns on endorphins. Endorphins, in 80% of people, will turn on our anti-pain control mechanism and make it so that we will turn off pain. And some people who are shot up in battle will not feel any pain at all because of the turning on of the endorphin system. And I wonder if I have time to tell you a story about nausea to illustrate how this occurs. All of us experience nausea all the time. Breath makes you nauseated. Your saliva makes you, your breakfast this morning made you nauseated. If you didn't eat breakfast this morning, that made you nauseated. We're nauseated all the time, the air, the water. But most of us never feel that because of the fact that this nausea sends the signal up, and then what happens? Brain turns on the endorphins. The endorphin turns on the anti-nausea system. The anti-nausea system quells the movement that you have down in the abdomen. So all of this is a chain reaction. There are some people who do not go through this. Apparently they do not have a strong enough signal, or the signal in the particular phase of the system that works endorphin does not turn on that particular endorphin that operates the nausea system, and therefore they have chronic nausea. Now remember all this because I'm going to ask you a trick question in a moment. Every large hospital has an anti-nausea clinic or a nausea clinic where they're working with people who have this chronic nausea. These are most miserable people. They go through life trying everything known to pharmacology for their chronic nausea, and they get no relief. At Sloan Kettering, they have a nausea clinic, and the man who was head of the nausea clinic was also working in the endorphin laboratory. One day he got a very brilliant idea. Since we know that faith is also involved in the amount of endorphins that we will turn on, the man decided to write a letter. It went like this. We have just received a new medication from England. It is reported to be very good for people who suffer from chronic nausea. If you would like to try this substance, come next Tuesday at 1:30 to receive the medication. The only requirement is that you be willing to be followed in our clinics for any possible ill effects that might occur. Well, the next week, a number of people showed up. They were given a small vial of a brown medication and told to take a small quantity of it every day and come back the following week for blood tests and other examinations that might reveal any kind of problem. When they came back, 80% of these chronically nauseated people for whom everything had been tried, 80% of them had total relief. They were absolutely overjoyed that they had total relief of their nausea for the first time, some of them in years. What do you suppose it was they were given? Okay. That's not a bad guess, but that's not right. It was not a placebo. A placebo does work in that way. The faith with the symptom turns on endorphins. And that does work in our various systems. So we're redefining all of our understanding of placebo medication since the past 9 years. It is no longer something that we use as a deception. Now we simply tell the patient, we're going to use a placebo for you. And let's see how it will work. Now, of course, those of us who have grown up with the idea that a placebo is given as a deception, we have a little difficulty putting that in the proper focus. But it is not at all bad to use a placebo under certain circumstances. But it was not a placebo. What do you think it was? It was not mind over matter, but that's also a good one. Somebody may have said something over here. Was not water. What did you say? No, it was not endorphins because they are not yet available commercially except in very tiny quantities at something like $100,000 an ounce. It was not morphine. The answer came from over here. Yes, something that would make you nauseated. Now, those of you who are in medicine, you know what that is. What is it? Syrup of Ipecac. That's what they gave them. A small quantity of syrup of Ipecac, which is used in pediatrics for people who swallow something that they do not know what it is. That children who swallow unknown things are sometimes given syrup of Ipecac. By the way, that is not the treatment of choice for this kind of accidental swallowing, but rather the use of charcoal. Give a large dose of charcoal, such as a tablespoonful or two, stirred in water, given to a child who has swallowed something that is an unknown substance, is a much better remedy in these instances. And do that first, and then call the poison control center. So these people have been given a small quantity of syrup of Ipecac. Now, what did that do? It sent a signal up to the brain. Brain produced a little more endorphin than it was capable of doing with the natural stimulus that the person was giving to the brain, and thereby it was enabled to produce sufficient endorphin to turn on its anti-nausea center. Much of medication, of treatments, of testing, of whatever is done that brings about a relief in symptoms works through this system. Some of you are aware of the fact that there have been a number of heart operations done, bypass operations done, which did not get completed, but the person has been opened up, and then for some reason the operation had to be stopped, and the person was just sewed up and sent back to his room. And yet, in the months that follow, these patients are shown to have some 40 to 80% relief of their symptoms in exactly the same fashion that a placebo works.
This is the end of Side 1. Please turn over the cassette now for the continuation of the message entitled, Simple Home Remedies.
All right. Question is this not getting back to homeopathy? In the beginning, I stated that we have so narrowed down our medical treatments and practice that we cannot take in any science except just certain very limited ones, And this is to our detriment. If we would bring in the best of every system of the healing arts, how much better it would be, such as in homeopathy. And these, some of the homeopathic system does operate much in the way of the endorphin and enkephalin system. Water treatments work in this way. Now, water treatments are anything from gargles and irrigations to hot baths and ice and steam. Any way that water can be applied upon or into the body, this is hydrotherapy. I'm sorry, I don't have time to describe lots of hydrotherapeutic techniques, but the techniques are so simple, so easy to do. You really do not have to describe much to a person when you tell them to take a hot bath. You don't have to go through a lot of demonstrations to tell people how to draw the water and this kind of thing. There are a few things that would be helpful for you to know, and these things we outline with completeness in our book called Home Remedies. This goes into hydrotherapy and massage. For a home massage, you will not need anything more than the information that we give in our book. It is complete along those lines. Question is burned toast a form of charcoal? And the answer is no, and I hope this goes on our tape this afternoon also. But burned toast is not charcoal. Charcoal is only charred cellulose, having had the protein and carbohydrate resins and oils and all of the softer parts, more flammable parts, burned out first. Those have been burned away and are no longer there. Charred toast is charred protein, charred fats, charred sugars, charred starches, and so forth. So it is not charcoal. Well, it does not start with the proper elements either. You see, you need to start with something that will leave a certain type of structure. All right, the next thing that I would like to talk with you about is something that we have in our book, Home Remedies, and that is the treatment of appendicitis. Now, those of us who have been trained in medicine, doctors and nurses and physical therapists and anybody else who's ever been trained in medicine, understands that the only treatment for appendicitis is surgical treatment. But I would like to tell you another treatment this morning, and that is the early successful treatment with cure of appendicitis. And each one of you can and should do it. Now, one of the primary principles in home remedies is that of getting started early. Do not wait until the person is nearly dead with a disease before you start the home remedies. One of the beauties of taking responsibility for your own health is that you experience that first symptom when it is only 20 minutes old. It is at that time that you should get started with your treatment. So start right in then. When you have a tummy ache, institute the treatment right then. Treat it as appendicitis. Now, the reason why I got the idea that people should be able to cure appendicitis is that when I practiced in pathology, I must have examined at least 10,000 appendices during my nearly 20 years of practicing pathology. And during that time, 20% of those appendices that came from a normal person, that is, they were not taken out for appendicitis, but were taken out in what we called incidental reasons, or an incidental, what some pathologists sign out as incidental appendix. 20% of those carried the diagnosis of scarred, partly obliterated appendix, meaning that the lumen had been totally obliterated. It no longer carried a lumen. Well, what had happened to that appendix? Does someone know? There's only one thing that could have happened. What was that? It had had appendicitis and it had healed. That's right. It had healed and scarred down and had obliterated the lumen. So we had had appendicitis that had healed. Therefore, we can know just from that not all appendicitis has to be operated on. So there are some cases that do heal. Could we institute a system of the treatment of appendicitis early in the game so that we would not have to take out the appendix? And I believe that we can. But you must start early. And often you have some other disorder that you're treating at the same time, because the thing that causes the appendicitis is the swelling of the lymphoid tissue. So as the lymphoid tissue swells out, it also swells in the appendix, making the lumen of the appendix smaller and smaller and smaller. Now about 60% of people who have appendicitis have it because of a stone in the appendix. The stone forms there because of a high calcium, high fat, high sugar diet, low fiber diet. A sludge forms in the appendix, which becomes calcified, and we get what we call a thecalith, a little stone in the appendix. When the appendix begins to swell, as it closes down on that stone, cuts off the blood supply, and the tissue dies right there around the stone. At that point, you start getting an infection and an inflammation. The inflammation spreads. Finally, the appendix ruptures, and the stone can even be evicted out into the abdominal cavity. And then, of course, you have a big abscess. 90% of patients, if they do not get operated on, do die when they're in that stage. So do not wait until they have a gangrenous appendix before you start treating appendicitis. Treat it with, what do you treat it with? The first symptom. Treat it upon the first symptom. So when the stomach ache comes, start with heat to the abdomen. Treat appendicitis with heat over the abdomen. Now you'll recognize that that's different from what we teach for a gangrenous appendix. Then what do you want to put over the appendix? Put cold, put an ice pack on the appendix when you have a well-developed case of appendicitis that any 8th grade schoolboy could diagnose. But early on, you may use enemas early. When you have the first sign of the stomach ache, use an enema. Use some charcoal by mouth. Give the person a massage that improves the immune system. Give them a deep breathing exercise. Control the diet very carefully so that they're not using a lot of sweets and a lot of fats. Abolish all animal products, which tend to slow down the activity of the bowel and often increases the production of mucus by the bowel, which may cause a blockage of the appendix and a sluggishness of the drainage of the appendix. So I believe that you can cure appendicitis. Now what about gallbladder disease? You'll hear that if you have gallstones, you should have your gallbladder removed. That's something that I would like to discuss with you. A number of years ago, the College of American Surgeons sent out a questionnaire to, I think, about 10,000 surgeons, as I recall the questionnaire. They received back from these surgeons about 2,000 answers. And one of the questions was this: if you have a patient who has gallbladder stones, do you recommend surgery? More than 80% of the surgeons who responded said that they did. The next question was this: if you yourself had gallstones, would you have a colleague of yours to remove them? Less than 20% said that they would. And I'm with that group. I would certainly not recommend that they be removed. But this is what I would do. I would not want to have another gallbladder attack. An attack of gallbladder colic is nobody's picnic, so you want to avoid that if you can. And here is what to do. Number one is stay well hydrated. Number two is to control the diet so that it is not high in calcium, high in fats, and high in sugar. Those three things promote the formation of gallstones. Another thing is use a high fiber diet. That would be fruits, vegetables, and whole grains. And fats should be totally abolished, since they do some things to the gallbladder that make it difficult for it to have its proper movement. And then if you still have some discomfort in the gallbladder area, another thing that you should do is to discover those foods to which you are sensitive. Now, in our book, Natural Remedies, which is the companion to the More Natural Remedies that has the hypertension article in it, in this book we have in Appendix A, a listing of all of those foods to which people are often sensitive. And so it would be well for the person who has gallbladder disease to read through that list and find out things that they might be sensitive to. It requires a good little bit of working with under some circumstances. Now I wonder if I could have an assistant to help me with my the next thing that I would like to present to you. And would you mind being my assistant? You will just step right up here and face this wall. And I'm going to need another assistant who will help me to hold the... do you mind, sir? Thank you. If you will just hold the microphone for me, I would appreciate that. Now, and you may need to stand around here sort of behind me and pull the microphone like that. Now, for the asthma, now there are two ways that you treat the asthma. You treat the acute attack, but you also do a maintenance of asthma. For the maintenance, there's a good bit written on it. We have a large section in our book, Natural Remedies, and many other places where we discuss asthma to some degree. In our book, Home Remedies, we have a good section on asthma. But for the acute attack that you would often send a person down to the emergency room for which they very likely might get a very small dose of adrenaline. But here is your little dose of adrenaline for them. The first thing that you need to do is to discover the waist, and then you discover the inferior angle of the scapula or the shoulder blade right here. So these two checkpoints, the waist and the inferior angle of the scapula. Halfway in between that, right up next to the spine, is the upper pole of the kidney. One finger breadth above that is the adrenal, the location of the adrenal. And what you want to do is a small massage stroke that you can easily learn, and I want you to learn that right now. So just take your wrist like this, and stabilizing the wrist and holding it still, then just make your hand wave back and forth. Now you're going to tap him with your fingertips, just like this, alternating the two hands. And you want to give as much force and as fast as you can, and you keep it up for as long as you can. Like that. Now, it stings the skin a little bit and makes it quite red, so you rub it a little bit. Now, the person is, of course, lying in bed, undressed. Now, you will do the other side in the same way, and then rub it a little bit like that, just to make the skin quit smarting. Now, that's one very good treatment. Now, another massage stroke that will do somewhat the same thing, and you should give these together, is what is called cupping. Now, if you will just cup your hands and strike yourself on the thigh and make a hollow sound. That's right. And you do want a hollow sound rather than a slapping sound. Now, you give a good smart whack on the back with your hand cupped like that. Usually I have the patient to brace himself against a bedpost or the wall, but I think that this patient will probably be able to handle things all right. So you just come back like this. It hurt?
Yeah.
Did it hurt?
No.
He said it didn't hurt. Okay. It is a little bit of a shock to the patient, and it's obvious that you would not want to do this to frail little old ladies. Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Yes. Okay. Question is, would this same treatment work for croup? It would work for anything that you would want to get a little adrenaline for. And since in croup there is often a need to dilate the bronchi, it would work very nicely in croup. It also works for sleepiness in meetings, and he shouldn't have any difficulty staying awake during the rest of the meeting. So pastors and school teachers and lecturers who have difficulty with people staying awake should remember this little treatment. There's a question right here.
Would this produce
All right. The question is about bee stings and acute allergic reactions from that and what to do. And if you will come to our meeting on charcoal, we will cover that. But this little remedy is a very good one for that. Now, I have one other remedy that I would like to show you now, and I know that a lot of you have questions. If you would not mind writing these out, I'll be happy to answer them at our 2 to 3 o'clock meeting this afternoon. But I need one other assistant, and do you mind, since you were so performed so well for the first one, if you would come up here and just go right across to this wall and face the wall, but stand away from the wall 2 feet. That's good right there. Now, not quite that far. That's about 2.5 feet. Get a little closer to the wall. That's it right there. Now, this is a treatment for backache. Now, the backache is a plague of many people, and some very simple things can help. We have a very good section in our books on it, in Home Remedies and in our Natural Remedies series. And you should read that if you have a problem with a backache. But here is a simple remedy. Brace yourself on the wall in front of you with your hands at shoulder level. And lean the chest right into the wall, keeping the heels flat on the floor. And hold that for 10 seconds. Now notice that his heels are flat on the floor. All right, now if I ask him, he's going to tell me a strange thing. Where do you feel your biggest pull? Is it in the back? Okay, he feels it in the neck. Okay, now is there another place where you feel a very strong pull? Okay, and in the chest. Now one other place. What about the calves? Okay, he feels a strong pull. Probably the strongest pull that he feels is in the calves. All right, now push away from the wall and hold that for 10 seconds and repeat it 3 times, but I would like for you to turn to the side in the same position, about 2 feet away from the wall. Turn with your side to the wall. That's right. Okay, and hold that just 1 minute, but let me speak a word to the folks. Now, what you have just seen with the face into the wall is good for the backache, and you do get a good stretch of all the ligaments all the way up and down. Now, there are other things that you can use for the back that will do similar things, but in the opposite plane. And one thing is to lie down on a well-padded floor, bring your knees up on your chest, bring your head up just a little bit, and rock from stem to stern on the floor. This gives you a self-chiropractic adjustment. And then, while you're still in the same position, knees right up on the chest, as close as you can get, it doesn't have to be too high up, then hit the floor on each side with the knees, back and forth. And that also will give you a self-chiropractic adjustment, and it's very good for the back. But also, this little remedy that you have just seen is the specific treatment for leg cramps. If a person has the leg cramps, they should do this 3 times a day for 60 days, and it will abolish the leg cramps. It's a very good treatment for that. If you will couple with that, taking good care that you do not chill the feet, that can be very helpful. Chilling of the feet a little bit is one of the primary causes of leg cramps at night. Now, with the person in the position that you now see our patient in, with the hip facing the wall and the hand bracing oneself at shoulder height, now you lean the hip into the wall from the 2-foot line. So he's doing it fine. That's it. Hip right into the wall. That's good. Now, the first one was easy, but this one is much harder. Now, this one is also held for 10 seconds, push away for 5. You may push away now, okay, and hold that for 5 seconds and repeat 3 times and turn the other way. Turn this way now. That's good. And from the same position, put the other hip against the wall, holding oneself very carefully. Make sure you don't let your feet slide out from under you. Now, this can be very helpful for the sciatica as well as for the backache. And this should be done 3 times a day for 60 days. All right, that will be all. Thank you very much. And I didn't tell him ahead of time, but this last remedy that you just saw is also a very good remedy for painful menstruation. Thank you. With some very simple things and a number of other things that you can find in the book, you will find some remedies for just very, very simple things. Maybe I'll tell you about colic right now. It's the last thing. The colic in infants. Mothers who have a baby with a colic, with a colicky history, need about as much help as the baby itself, because the mother suffers right along with the baby. To have an inconsolably crying baby is a very trying experience, and nobody except a mother who has lived through it can really be sympathetic with a mother who is going through it. And I'm certainly glad that neither of my children had colic, but I have certainly suffered through the colic with a large number of my patients, and it's a miserable experience. So here is what to tell the mother to do. There are several ways that you can treat it, and we deal with it in our book, but I want to tell you a nice little remedy that often works. Put the baby in an infant seat. Secure the infant seat on top of the washing machine and do a load of washing. And the little jarring that occurs will soothe the baby, and the heat that comes up will relax the baby, and it's a very good remedy for the colic. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to Dr. Agatha Thrash speaking at the 1985 Michigan Organic State Fair Harvest Festival. International copyright, 1985, American Cassette Ministries. All rights reserved. This cassette is protected by international copyright laws and thus protected against all copying, duplication, and transcriptions. Please understand, it is illegal to copy this cassette. For additional copies of this cassette, as well as our latest gift catalog, please write to American Cassette Ministries. Our address is Post Office Box 922, Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. Our postal zip code is 17108 in the United States of America. Waiting to serve you, this is American Cassette Ministries. We're a nonprofit corporation helping prepare America and the world to meet Jesus Christ. Thank you.